physically, that is. Other locals were enraged by Knight's actions. The actual items he stole might be minor, but he also took people's peace of mind, their sense of security. Some said they were afraid to sleep in their own cabins, afraid for decades. "I felt violated over and over and over again," said Debbie Baker, who has owned a place on North Pond with her husband for more than 20 years. "I lost count how many times he broke in." Her two sons, when they were young, were terrified of the hermit. They had nightmares about him. The family installed security lights and deadbolts and even had a police officer spend much of the night, but nothing worked. "I hate what this man did to us," Baker said. Martha Patterson, whose cabin was a frequent target, said that Knight stole some of the silverware she'd inherited from her mother and a couple of cherished hand-sewn quilts, but the real damage went deeper. All Patterson wanted from her cabin was a place to escape the pressures of daily life, and Knight denied her that. "I couldn't leave my windows open. I couldn't even go and sit by the beach without worrying," she said. "He stole every bit of my piece of heaven." "If someone needed food," said Mary Hinckley, a victim of dozens of break-ins, "I would give them food. Just ask. But we were invaded, completely invaded. I always feared he'd come in the night when my grandchildren were there. I despise this person. I'm ashamed I feel this way. But I do. I can't think of anything in my life I've been so bitter about." If Knight really wanted to live in the woods, many said, he should have done so on public lands, hunting and fishing for food. And how was anyone supposed to know he wasn't armed and dangerous? Even a single break-in can be punishable by a 10-year prison sentence. Knight was nothing but a lazy man and a thief times 1,000. He should be locked up in the state penitentiary, perhaps for life. The person who was going to decide what punishment, if any, to seek against Knight was Megan Maloney, the district attorney. Maloney grew up in Maine in a blue-collar family, living in subsidized housing. She was the valedictorian of her high school class and won a scholarship to Harvard Law. She'd heard public opinion on Knight. "Free him now. Incarcerate him forever." And she, too, was conflicted. "In a lot of ways," said Maloney, "the law is not set up for an outlier case like this." Knight himself was not seeking leniency. "There's no justification for my stealing," he said, "and I don't want people trying to justify my bad behavior in an attempt not to sully what they admire in me. Take the whole package, good and bad. Judge me on that. Don't cherry-pick. Don't make excuses for me." "Everyone makes excuses," said Terry Hughes, who witnessed Knight's confession in the Pine Tree dining room. "Criminals will deny, deny, deny. That's what you deal with when you deal with criminals. That's the world we live in. I'm used to that world." Hughes said that he had never encountered a person as guilelessly straightforward about his crimes as Knight. "He just owned up to everything," Hughes pointed out. Knight had no problem admitting to 1,000 burglaries. He understood that it was wrong. He was embarrassed and remorseful. But there was total acknowledgement. "Everything in my gut wanted to hate this guy," said Hughes. "I'm a typical stubborn jarhead. He stole food from a camp for disabled people. But I can't hate him. You could work in law enforcement 100 years and never come across anyone like this." "It's a very strange case, for sure," said Knight's pro bono defender, Walter McKee, who is renowned in Maine for his work ethic and his expertise. McKee arrives at his office each day at 3:15 a.m. He is also a classical violinist, a mountaineer, a private airplane pilot, a father, and a husband. "Mr. McKee does not sleep," reports his firm's website. He consented to waive Knight's right to a speedy trial in order to determine how best to proceed. The modern hermit community, it exists, also debated Knight's merits. On the Hermitary website is an area called Hermit's Slate, which is described as a forum for hermits, solitaries, anchorites, recluses, introverts. Before you're allowed to post there, the administrator of the Hermitary site, who uses the pen name Meng Hu, must decide whether you are a legitimate hermit. There are currently more than 1,000 members. Perhaps not surprisingly, there are seldom more than 2 or 3 online at once. The general consensus among Hermitary denizens seems to be that Knight should not be considered a hermit. He was more of an insult to hermits. Meng Hu wrote a blog post about hermits like Knight. "The idea of a hermit who steals for a living confirms the worst stereotype of the eremite as parasite," noted Meng Hu. "No historical hermit, especially those motivated by a spiritual sense, but also wilderness hermits, has ever had the slightest motive to encroach upon anybody's belongings, be that body, mind, time, space, or goods." "Stealing," added Meng Hu, "is universally condemned by other hermits because it shows that one is undisciplined, lacking in empathy, and a menace to society, which are all contradictory to hermit ideals." Knight, official hermit or not, was unable to afford bail, so he remained in the Kennebec County Jail. Within days of being locked up, he caught a debilitating head cold, but after that, his immune system kicked in, and he managed to avoid further illness. He received a new pair of glasses, his first in 30 years, with oval lenses and silver wire frames. He lost weight and became as gaunt as after a grim winter in the woods. Now that food was freely given to him, he joked, he couldn't eat. But the truth was that jail made him too nervous to have an appetite. "He was a model inmate," says Chief Deputy Sheriff Ryan Reardon. "His beard, his timepiece, and his disguise grew wildly and ever more itchy, but he refused to shave." Knight had figured that both his parents had died while he was in the woods, but soon after his capture, Diane Vance, who'd run a background check, told him that his mother, Joyce Knight, was still alive. She was in her 80s. Chris begged Vance not to contact her or anyone else in his family, and she agreed. He wished to remain a secret, even in jail. 6 days after his arrest, Knight was informed by Vance that the story had leaked. His mother would soon learn about him through the media. Knight gave Vance permission to notify his mom that he'd been found. She telephoned Mrs. Knight. "I didn't beat around the bush," said Vance. "I just broke the news to her. I think she was in shock, because it's quite possible she thought he was dead. Then I think she ended up being mad because he was in jail and had been committing crimes. I remember her saying, 'At my age, it's a lot to take in.'" Knight accepted a single jail visit from his brothers Joel and Timothy. It was Joel who had co-signed the loan on the brat that Chris had abandoned. According to Carrie Vieg, the family friend, Joel paid off the full amount owed and never pressed charges. "Joel thought that was not a brotherly thing to do," Vieg noted. Chris did not allow his mother to come. He said that a visit with his mother would cause her shame and grief.
"Look at me. I'm in my prison clothes. I couldn't let her see me like this. I'm a thief. I'm in jail, guilty of so many crimes. This is not something my mom raised me to be. This is no place for her."
It was for the same reason, Knight said, that he never phoned home the whole time he was in the woods.
"Because who I was, a hermit, a thief, would offend my family's belief system. It would embarrass them. I couldn't tell them."
Instead, he allowed his family to wonder endlessly, to ache. A confounding choice. He decided that he would see his mother only once he was released from jail, so they could speak properly, face to face. But after 6 months of imprisonment, he had no idea when that might be. His skin had broken out in hives, and his hands sometimes trembled. Just finding out how many more seasons he'd be spending locked up might have reduced some of his stress, but he understood the delay.
"I don't fit into any categories," he said. "Apparently they don't get a lot of hermits these days."
So he sank back into himself, clutching the threads of his sanity, waiting to learn of his fate. Chapter 25. A side door to the jail swings open, and three sheriff's deputies emerge, armed and wearing bulletproof vests, along with a prisoner, hands cuffed in front, his beard like Spanish moss. One deputy stations himself ahead of Knight, the other two grip each elbow, and they march him across Court Street toward the Kennebec County Courthouse with its sentry of granite columns. Red and yellow leaves scatter in the fall breeze, and television cameras are shoved into Knight's face, but he manages to remain impassive, his gaze directed at some unseen spot in front of him. The upstairs courtroom is all dark wood and maroon carpeting, with a giant brick fireplace in one corner, the walls a haunted house display of oil paintings of old judges staring sternly from gilded frames. A memorial service was held here to commemorate Abraham Lincoln after his assassination in 1865. Wooden pews in the back creak with spectators, and the press photography and television section is full, everyone awaiting Knight's arrival. Boxes of files are carried about. McKee, Knight's attorney, wears a dark suit. Maloney, the DA, a fire engine red jacket. Knight's brother, Joel, same thin lips, same sharp nose, sits with his son and daughter, both of whom look to be in their 20s. This is the first time they will see their uncle. The son's leg bounces, and I overhear Joel saying,
"Nerves, perfectly normal."
Knight is brought in, stationed behind the defense table, and uncuffed. The room quiets. A court officer says, "All rise," and Justice Nancy Mills appears like a magic trick through a red curtain hanging over a doorway. She smooths her black robe and sits down, then sets a pair of reading glasses low on her nose and begins. For those not charting moons or seasons or chin hair, it's Monday, October 28th, 2013, nearly 7 months after Knight's arrest. A solution has been found. Knight will plead guilty to 13 counts of burglary and theft. The vast majority of his raids could not be prosecuted because of a 6-year statute of limitations, and many were never reported at all. And instead of going to prison, he will be admitted into the co-occurring Disorders and Veterans Court. This is a program that substitutes counseling and judicial monitoring for incarceration, designed for defendants facing criminal charges who are also affected by substance abuse and mental illness, the co-occurring disorders. In Knight's case, his afflictions are alcoholism and either Asperger's syndrome, depression, or schizoid personality disorder. These labels may not be precisely accurate, but even the DA agrees that a long prison sentence for Knight would be cruel, and admitting him to the program is a way to legally resolve the case. Knight stands, clasps his hands behind his back, and Maloney reads the charges. If it weren't for the gravity of the proceedings, they might sound humorous. "On or about July 14th, 2008, Maloney intones, "Mr. Edmund Ashley reported items stolen from his camp in Rome, Maine. The items stolen were batteries, food, and soda, with an approximate value of $18. Justice Mills asks for Knight's plea.
"Guilty," he says, scarcely audible.
A seasonal resident's kitchen window had been forced open, Maloney continues, and food items, along with a pair of men's size 38 jeans and a leather belt, had been stolen with a value of approximately $40.
Guilty.
On it goes, 11 more times. Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty and for no other reason? Asks Justice Mills when it's done.
Yes.
Do you understand what we're doing?
Yes.
I am satisfied that Mr. Knight's pleas are voluntary, says Mills. Then she reviews the conditions of his sentence. Knight will serve a total of 7 months in jail. He has another week to go. And once released, must seek psychological counseling. He needs to call his case manager every day. He has to appear in court every Monday at 11 a.m. so Mills can review his progress. These rules will be in effect for at least 1 year, and if he breaks any of them, he could be subject to as much as a 7-year term in the state prison. He is also fined a total of about $2,000 to be distributed to his victims. He will live at home with his mother and must find a job or go to school, and he must perform community service. He may not contact any of his victims or leave the state of Maine, and he is prohibited from using or possessing alcohol. He will be subject to random drug and alcohol testing. Obviously, Mills adds, you can't get involved in any further criminal trouble of any kind. Do you understand that, Mr. Knight?
Yes.
Any questions or anything else you would like to say, Mr. Knight?
No, he says. And the hearing is over.
A few hours later, I visit Knight in jail for the final time. It's our 9th one-hour visit over the course of 2 months, encompassing 4 trips to Maine. There are telephones in jail, but he has steadfastly refused to make a call, though we speak through receivers during our visits. He hasn't placed a phone call in 30 years, and even before he went into the woods, he didn't like phones.
People earnestly say to me here, Mr. Knight, we have cell phones now, and you're going to really enjoy them. That's an enticement for me to rejoin society. You're going to love it, they say. I have no desire.
And what about a text message? Isn't that just using a telephone as a telegraph? We're going backwards.
When he hears how songs are now shared and downloaded, Knight is equally unimpressed.
You're using your computers, your $1,000 machines, to listen to the radio? Society is taking a rather strange turn.
He says he'll stick with vinyl records. With his release imminent, Knight seems more unsettled than ever. He scratches furiously at his knees. Jail, he's realized, might not be all bad. There's routine and order in jail, and he's able to click into a survival mode that is not too dissimilar, in terms of steeliness of mental state, to the one he'd perfected during winters in the woods.
I'm surrounded in here by less than desirable people, he says, but at least I wasn't thrown into the waters of society and expected to swim.
Now he is being tossed into public life, and he's frightened. It's not the big things, like getting a job or relearning to drive, that worry him, but the little ones, like eye contact and gestures and emotions, all of which can be badly misinterpreted.
I'm extremely emotionally thin-skinned. I need therapy. I realize that.
He feels like the stakes are high for him. He's fearful that he is going to make a mistake that will send him to prison. The punishment looms over him like a guillotine.
I have no preparation for re-entry into society. I don't know your world, only my world, and memories of the world before I went to the woods. What is life today? What is proper? There are blank spots in my skill set. I have to figure out how to live.
He refers to what's happening to him, literally and metaphorically, as his double winter. He was arrested as one winter was ending, and will be released as the next is beginning. It's going to be a year without summer, like when Krakatoa blew. He's been invited into the family home, to the 60-acre plot in the town of Albion, back to his boyhood bedroom.
They don't approve of what I did, but I am still part of the family. I am grateful.
He will move in with his mother and his sister, with his brother Daniel close by. Even after decades, his home looms large in his memory. He saw a picture of the house in a newspaper story and noticed right away that it had been painted a slightly different color. He is unimpressed with what he's learned in jail of the society he is about to enter, and is certain he is not going to fit in. Everything moves at light speed, without rest.
It's too loud, too colorful. The lack of aesthetics, the crudeness, the inanities, the trivia, the inappropriate choices of aspirations and goals.
He admits that he's really not in a position to judge. He says that when he is released, he is going to avoid even the intimation of wrongdoing. He will hew to the law and keep clean.
I don't want people questioning my questionable judgment.
His job prospects, he knows, are dim.
Money, huh? I've got to reacquire the taste for money. I intend to get a job, but my resume is rather thin.
He has low expectations of employment, low and slow. Washing dishes, stocking shelves. He was actually offered a sort of internship while in jail. The owner of a local organic farm contacted the DA's office and said she had an idea to introduce Knight to her style of growing crops. The farm is plowed by horse and oxen and has a roadside stand that sells homemade pies, jams, and sun-dried tomato pesto. There are sleigh rides for kids in winter. The owner spoke of how the farm healed her family, and she thought it could do the same for Knight. She was permitted to present the offer to Knight in person at the jail. Knight tried his hardest, he says, to remain polite and cooperative during the meeting.
I talked farming. I know about farming. I talked about the whole hippie experience thing, the back-to-the-land movement, worshipping nature. I think I gave her the wrong idea that I wanted to work in the fields.
Neighbors of the farm, according to Knight, were nervous about the notion of him being there, and the owner rescinded the offer. Knight was pleased that the crop-picking idea collapsed.
Me bent over in the hot fields after all those years in the shade of the woods was not going to happen.
I tell Knight that I can research employment opportunities for him, quiet jobs like security guard or librarian, and he shakes his head vigorously. No.
Please leave me alone, he says.
The best thing I can do is not help him. Help is a kind of relationship. Next thing you know, I'll be asking to be his friend, and he doesn't want to be my friend.
I'm not going to miss you at all, he adds.
He is a connoisseur of the arc of the seasons and the scent of the wind, but he can't really see anyone else. I've told him a little about my family and my pastimes, and he didn't even bother to feign much interest. He doesn't know what to do with the information, what questions to ask. He knows people only peripherally, by the food in their pantry and the decorations on their walls. His only real relationship was between him and the forest. Knight thinks of himself both as a common criminal and as a Nietzschean Übermensch, a superman, subject to no one else's rules, a master of self-discipline capable of transcending the vapidity of life. He has told me his story and asked for nothing in return, but he admits that he wonders which version of him I will portray.
"I'm worried about having my identity applied by someone else," he says. "I don't particularly trust you. I don't distrust you either. I'm taking measure of the man. There are certain threadbare spots in your measure. You have the ability to do harm or good. Do what you think is right."
He really only had a single curiosity about me. What books were on my shelves? He asks me to take a video of them and send it to him. He says he'll find a way to get the technology to work. "Make the video," he says, "but mail no more books or letters, and certainly do not pay a visit to his home.
Once I get out of here, you're off my dance card. I can't afford the indulgence that is you. I deny you my magnificent presence." Did you get my dance card reference, or do I have to update my references? Did you read Little Women?
He especially detests my aggressiveness, my coming to speak with him so many times.
"You get a bee in your bonnet, and there's no stopping you."
He says that he regrets writing back to me. Then he backpedals. He fears, he adds, that he is being too hostile. He did get something out of the visits.
Some stress release.
But he has grown weary of talking about himself. Mostly what he wants me to do is just slow down and let time pass.
"Don't be a pest," he says. "I'll speak to you when the lilacs bloom, and maybe not even then."
I ask him if by lilacs blooming he means next year, and he says,
"Yes, in spring. I don't use years yet."
Night is no longer able to disappear into the wild, not without risking 7 years in prison. So he wishes to melt into the world. A guard comes to escort him away, and I thank him for speaking with me, for sharing his ideas, for the lyricism of his language. I tell him I like the way his mind works.
"Goodbye, Chris," I say.
"Good luck." There is time for Knight to express a last thought. He does not. There's no wave, no nod. He stands up, turns his back on me, and walks out of the visiting booth and down a corridor of the jail. Chapter 26. Chris's oldest brother, Daniel, provides him with a job. Daniel runs a scrap metal recycling business, and he begins hauling old automobile and tractor engines to Chris, who takes them apart in a shed on his family's property. He is not getting paid. It's in exchange for room and board. But he works alone, fulfilling his employment requirement without social interaction. Each Monday, a family member drives him to Augusta for his meeting at the courthouse. He never misses one, and he's never late. He follows the rules of his punishment to the letter. "He is doing a remarkable job," says Megan Maloney. "He has been working hard to understand what it takes to become part of society again. He hasn't had a single setback. I often see him on Mondays and say hi. We always talk a bit. He seems to be content." He registers to vote as an independent. Phil Dow, the president of the Albion Historical Society, has known the Knight family for 50 years. Joyce Knight calls him one day and asks if there's any work Chris might do to accomplish his community service. "I told her I'd love to have him," says Dow. About once a week, Dow drives to Knight's home and brings him to the train station. The village of Albion, enthuses Dow, has one of the few remaining narrow-gauge railroad stations in the world. The tracks are 2 feet apart, less than half the standard dimension, easier and cheaper to lay across difficult terrain. Passengers and freight were transported on this line through central Maine from the late 1800s until June 15, 1933, when a train going around a curve broke the outside rail and tumbled down a bank of the Sheepscot River. The Albion Historical Society is restoring the cedar-sided two-story station. Knight is volunteering as a painter.
"He doesn't talk much," says Dow, "though I don't really let him because I'm such a ratchet jaw, but he seems happy."
While Knight was still in jail, a woman named Alice MacDonald, who went to high school with him, sent him a letter. She was a couple of years older, she wrote, but she remembered Knight and hoped to conduct Bible study lessons with him. Knight did not want the lessons, but something about MacDonald interested him. She wasn't prying to get at his story and seemed to have no ulterior motives. She knew him from before the woods. She was female. They met several times at the jail, his only other regular visitor, and Knight continues to see her.
"So, you have a girlfriend," I'd teased, feather gentle, during our final jailhouse meeting.
"No, I'm not engaging in a romance, if that nasty little thought crossed your mind," Knight replied, knocked over by my feather.
The visits with MacDonald were also non-contact, the window between them. He did say he preferred speaking with a woman.
"She's a nice lady. She provides me comfort. She got emotional one day and said, 'I wish I could hug you.' I found the idea of her touching me to be an alien idea."
Knight's double winter progresses, and I fulfill his assignment by filming all the books in my house 16 minutes of unviral video. I mail the disc to him, but hear nothing back. I don't even know if it reaches him. Every time I hike in the forest, and other times too, I wonder how he's doing.
"The state can run him through programs," said Terry Hughes, "and he may do fine, but then again, on some Monday or Tuesday morning, he could walk out the door and go back to the woods."
I keep expecting to hear that he's gone, but the news never comes. I telephone Daniel Knight to inquire about Chris. Daniel answers, and I introduce myself, and he says, "No thanks," and hangs up. His brother Jonathan, who lives in Fairbanks, Alaska, hangs up without a word. Timothy never answers. Joel Knight runs an auto repair shop in the tourist town of Belfast on the Maine coast. I take a trip to Maine in which I do not contact Chris, but drive over to Joel's shop and walk in. There's a flurry of activity in the four-bay garage, but Joel is easy to spot, in a black T-shirt, dipping in and out of the rear of an SUV, holding a drill, then a wrench, moving fluidly about the small space inside the vehicle. Natural physical grace seems to run in the Knight family.
"He's a genius with my Prius," says the co-owner of Left Bank Books, the town's independent bookstore.
The co-owner says that of course everyone in town knows about Joel's brother.
"I could never ask him about Chris," she adds. "I don't know Joel that well."
She does, however, share the town rumor, likely apocryphal, that Chris's mother continued to celebrate his birthday, even with a cake, for many years. I walk across the garage and introduce myself to Joel, and I see from the look on his face, not mean, but firm, that we aren't going to speak much. His hands are dirty, and we don't shake. Joel does confirm that no one in his family ever knew where Chris was, and that as far as he knows, no one ever helped Chris, no one saw him, and anyone who thinks he's lying is mistaken. It is clear from his tone that he doesn't understand Chris's actions either.
"When did you start to believe that Chris had died?"
"That's personal."
"What was it like when he returned home?"
"That's personal."
Joel slips back into the car. Conversation over. I also stop by Chris's girlfriend Alice MacDonald's house. She opens her front door and says, "I can't speak with you," and closes it. When I call his mother and tell her I'd like to chat about Chris, she says,
"I understand,"
and disconnects me. Phil Dow of the Historical Society says that Joyce Knight told him it's good to have Chris back. She reported that his appetite has returned and he's been devouring the groceries.
She loves to see him eat, says Dow.
One thing does elicit a response. I mail Chris a holiday card with a photo of my three children, and a couple of weeks later I receive a note written in familiar, shaky print, black ink on a white index card.
Such a display of beauty and happiness is not possible without contentment, he says about the holiday card.
He refers to my children endearingly as the cowboys.
Well done, he adds. Solstice greetings? Acknowledgement? Whatever.
There is no name, as usual, but it warms me to hear from him. It seems like getting out of jail has softened him a bit. That note, 34 words long, is all I get. 7 months after we parted in jail, I again returned to Maine. On the drive from the airport, I stop by the Fox Hill Lilac Nursery and purchase a large sprig of purple lilacs. It's my olive branch. Then I head to Hillman's Bakery in Fairfield and buy an apple pie, a gift for his mother. Past lumber mills and antiques shops, bed and breakfasts, and above-ground swimming pools, a couple of wild turkeys strut along the road's shoulder. There are farm eggs for sale on a folding table at the end of a driveway, but no person there, just a box for the money. Central Maine is still on the honor system. It takes 40 seconds to drive the length of Albion's Main Street, post office, library, gas station, church, general store. At the store, a bulletin board has handwritten signs for diesel engine repair, yoga classes, snow removal, and hunting guides. There are no traffic lights. At both ends of the town are clusters of white or tan wood-sided homes set close to the road. Then it's countryside again. A dairy farm, a place that will butcher your deer, a vest pocket cemetery with a few tombstones nearly 200 years old. The Knight house is mostly hidden behind a wall of hedges and trees. Only the second floor windows, with bright blue shutters, are visible from the road, two rectangular eyes peering out of the greenery. A black mailbox says Joyce W. Knight on it, beside two newspaper boxes, one for the Portland Press Herald, one for the Morning Sentinel. A giant red maple dominates the front yard. I pull my rental car into the short dirt drive in front of a small garage separate from the house that has a weather vane on top and a metal sign that says in embossed letters, Sheldon C. Knight. The yard is quiet. There's no sign of another vehicle. No one seems to be at home. I sit in the car for a moment, wondering what to do. Something about the house makes me nervous, though it's unremarkable in every way. Just a boxy, wood-sided place, painted pale yellow, with a couple of asphalt roof tiles in need of replacing. I get out of the car, carrying the lilac sprig and the apple pie, and take a few strides toward the front door, when out of the bushes, soundlessly, steps Chris Knight. Chapter 27. He's shaved, the wild whiskers now a smooth, rounded chin. He is wearing a brown and tan plaid flannel shirt tucked into faded blue jeans and a brown baseball cap with no insignia. He still has the silver-framed bifocals given to him in jail. On his feet are old leather work boots. I hold out the lilac branch, drooping with flowers, and Knight looks at it crossly. It's like offering a glass of water to a fish. There are lilacs, I now notice, blooming pink, purple, and white everywhere on the Knight property. I lower the branch and lift my other hand, like a waiter, pie box on my palm. I brought something for your mother, I say. Knight's eyes slide over to the box.
No, he says firmly.
I retreat to my car, open the driver's side door, set down the lilacs and the pie, and shut the door. We stand there, unnaturally far apart.
Can I shake your hand? I ask.
We'd never had the chance. A wall had always separated us.
I'd rather not, Knight answers.
So we don't. Knight indicates, twisting his head, for me to follow him. We walk behind the garage with the weather vane on top, out of sight of the road, in the perfumey breeze of a lilac tree, branches grazing our heads. The grass is vivid green after a week of rain. Apple trees bloom with white flowers, the forerunners to fruit. Nearby is the weathered wooden shed, sagging, where Knight does his salvage work. There are swarms of no-see-ums, flying grains of pepper, and I continually brush them away, but don't grab or slap. Even during our jail visits, I'd tried to keep my gestures in check around Knight to preserve his calm. His movements were always so clean and careful. Knight seems not at all disturbed by the insects. Everyone I'd spoken with in his circle, without exception, had exclaimed how ably he was adjusting. He appears healthy, and his skin has a nice color. He's still thin. The end of his belt dangles, but not emaciated like he once was. The lack of a beard skews him younger. He's been to a dentist. One tooth has been removed, I see, and the rest are shiny and clean. But one of the first things he says is that the optimistic face he's displayed in public is false, another mask. In truth, he's hurting.
I'm not doing very well,
he admits, gazing over my shoulder in his usual manner. Nobody understands him, he tells me. People constantly take offense at what he says. They misconstrue me as arrogant. I feel like I'm in high school all over again. He sacrificed everything else in the world for complete autonomy. And now he's nearly 50 years old and not allowed to make simple decisions for himself. The judge, his counselors, and his therapist, says Knight, speak to him as though he's a child. Every time he admitted he was struggling, they fed him platitudes. Knight rattles them off.
Oh, it'll get better. Look on the bright side. The sun will come up tomorrow.
He grew tired of hearing them. So now he keeps quiet. He doesn't blame anyone.
Everyone's doing their best, he says, in a way that can be construed as arrogant.
But following their rules causes him to feel worse. Jail, in some sense, was preferable. Now that he's free, it is clear that he isn't. He reaches into a front pocket of his jeans and pulls out a watch with a broken strap. His family, he says, doesn't want him speaking with me. If they knew I was here, they'd be upset. The timing of my visit is good, but we don't have long. His mother is coming home soon, and then his brother needs to drive him to Augusta for his drug testing. He shakes his head. He's never in his life used illegal drugs, not so much as a toke of pot, yet this is how he must spend his afternoon.
I'm a square peg, he says.
Everybody he encounters, he feels, is smashing at him, pounding on him, trying to jam him into a round hole. Society seems no more welcoming to him than before he left. He fears he may be forced to take psychotropic medicines, drugs that will mess with his brain, when he already knows exactly how to fix everything. All he needs to do is return to his camp. Though, of course, he can't. He must perform the whole dog and pony show of his punishment.
Am I crazy? He asks.
He says he received the video of my books, but that lately he's not even interested in reading. He asks again,
"Am I crazy?"
Knight looks at me, and actually holds eye contact for a few beats, and I can read the sadness. While in jail, he had always felt emotionally closed off. Possibly it was the cumbersome arrangement of the visiting booth, the glass wall, the staticky phone receivers, the lack of privacy. Now his face has taken on a new dimension, no longer cold and off-putting. He is reaching out. He seems to be asking for help. Maybe the best way to forge a bond with a true hermit is to leave him alone for a while. In jail he was orating, pontificating. Now we are speaking. Some connection has formed. We aren't friends, but perhaps we are acquaintances. By explaining to me how nobody else understood him, he may have hinted that he feels like I do have some understanding. I say to him, truthfully, that I don't believe he is crazy. Then, as if to challenge my conclusion, he suddenly asks me a seemingly random question.
"What do you think I'm talking about when I say the Lady of the Woods?"
I'm speaking allegorically.
"Mother Nature, I guess."
"No," he says.
"Death."
Knight's question wasn't random. Death, in fact, is the subject he most wants to talk about. He says that he's seen the Lady of the Woods before, during a very bad winter. His food was finished, his propane used up, and the cold was unrelenting. He was in his bed, in his tent, starving, freezing, dying. The lady appeared. She was wearing a hooded sweater, a feminine grim reaper. She lifted an eyebrow and lowered her hood. She asked if he was going with her or staying. He says he's aware, on an intellectual level, that it was just some fevered, desperate hallucination. But he's still not entirely sure. He tells me he has a plan. He is going to wait for the first really frigid day, probably in late November, 6 or so months from now, and he will set out into the forest wearing very little clothing. He will walk as deep into the woods as he can. Then he is going to sit down and allow nature to take care of him. He will freeze himself to death.
"I'm going to walk with the Lady of the Woods," he says.
He thinks about this all the time. He realizes he's caught in an impossible trap. If he seeks liberty by returning to his camp, he'll be locked up. He craves to touch, embrace, accept relief. He's done some research. Hypothermia, he believes, is a painless way to die.
"It's the only thing that will make me free."
He stands stiffly, hands in his jean pockets.
"Something's got to give," he says, "or something's going to break."
And this is the line that breaks him. His voice catches, and his stoicism crumbles, and the humanity beneath pushes out, and I glance at his face and see tears sliding down his cheeks. I can't help it. I cry as well. Two grown men standing beneath a lilac tree on a gorgeous spring day. Knight is able, after all, to interact with another person, and do so in the most open and vulnerable way. And right then, I come the closest I think I ever will to understanding why Knight left. He left because the world is not made to accommodate people like him. He was never happy in his youth, not in high school, not with a job, not being around other people. It made him feel constantly nervous. There was no place for him, and instead of suffering further, he escaped. It wasn't so much a protest as a quest. He was like a refugee from the human race. The forest offered him shelter.
"I did it because the alternative was..." I wasn't content, says Knight. I did find a place where I was content.
I think that most of us feel like something is missing from our lives, and I wondered then if Knight's journey was to seek it. But life isn't about searching endlessly to find what's missing. It's about learning to live with the missing parts. Knight had been away too long, and I sensed that there was no coming back. He had a brilliant mind, but all his thinking had only trapped him alone in the woods.
Yeah, the brilliant man, says Knight. The brilliant man went to find contentment, and he did. The brilliant man wishes he weren't so stupid to do illegal things to find contentment.
During nearly every visit in the county jail, Knight had chastised me for a few moments about abandoning my wife and the cowboys, neglecting my fatherly duties to talk with him. I'd found it amusing. He had shirked all responsibility entirely. But in the end, he was right. I saw what happened to Knight and felt only the urge to go home. For Knight, his camp was the one spot on the planet where he knew he belonged. His existence had been extraordinarily challenging at times, but he'd made it work. So he had remained there as long as he could. He doesn't want to sit in a shed taking apart engines. He has known something far more profound, and that sense of loss feels unbearable. I understand all this, yet I'm powerless to change anything or relieve his pain. We stand there, our tears streaming. He will return to the trees, his real home, even if it is just to die.
I miss the woods, he says.
Knight fishes out his watch once more. He says he probably won't see me ever again. It was risky to speak even this once against his family's wishes. There won't be another conversation. After he's gone, he says, I can tell his story any way I want.
You're my Boswell, he declares.
He no longer cares what's written about him. I'll be with the Lady of the Woods.
I'll be happy, he tells me.
You can make T-shirts with my image on them if you wish, and have your kids sell them on the corner. I smile at the idea, suspending my tears. The world is a confusing place, meaningful and meaningless at once.
It was good to see you, he says.
He walks me around the garage to my car and leaves me there. His mother will be coming any minute.
Go,
he whispers.
Go, and I do.
Chapter 28. A mile down the road, I pull over. He just told me he was going to kill himself, that he has a detailed plan for it. Now what am I supposed to do? Keep it a secret? Call the police, his family, a caseworker? Do I have a legal responsibility? A moral one? I drive to my hotel in a panic and phone a couple of therapists for advice. The legal part is clear. A man who says he's going to kill himself in 6 months is not making an imminent threat. It doesn't matter if Knight passes time like a tree, his 6 months not like our 6 months. I could take him to the police or a hospital and they wouldn't hold him against his will. Morally, things are murkier. To me, Knight is serious about his threat, no question. Catherine Benoit, a clinical psychologist in private practice near Chicago, agrees. He meets several criteria that would classify him as being at a very high potential for suicide. His need for autonomy, Benoit adds, only amplifies this likelihood, as suicide can be considered the ultimate expression of independence. Thomas Frazier of the Center for Autism in Cleveland seconds this opinion. He's at very, very high risk for suicide. Peter Derry, the clinical psychologist in New York, says, I would worry about him. I worry all night, and in the morning I decide to return to his home and tell him in person that I'm conflicted. We'll talk it out, I'm thinking, like I'd do with a real friend. I drive the rural roads toward Albion, and just before his house I approach his brother's place, where the garage door is open, and inside, tinkering with an engine, is a man. Thin. Glasses. Jeans. Baseball cap. It's Chris. I pull over. The man in the garage looks up. It's not him. It's Daniel. We see each other. I'm stopped on the side of the road, close enough to talk, so I feel like I have little choice but to get out and say hello. I'm pulling the door handle when I notice up the street a man frantically waving at me. This time it is Chris. I drive away from Daniel awkwardly, without speaking, and park in front of the garage with the weather vane. Chris approaches my car and motions for me to lower the window. I do not. I open the door and step out. He's extremely agitated. He witnessed my brief encounter with Daniel and says I've done terrible damage. Knight's face, I see, has closed again. The previous day, he had been so willing to reveal himself, and now he's snapped shut. I explained that I was afraid of what he'd told me about the Lady of the Woods.
I was just exploring an idea, he says angrily.
He's retreating from his threats, it's clear, to get rid of me.
Go back to Montana, Knight says. The cowboys need their father. Leave me alone, now.
He walks inside his house without another word, and for the second time in 2 days, I drive back to my hotel, upset. This time I call real estate agents. It doesn't seem healthy for a middle-aged man to live in his childhood room. A tiny cabin, roof caved in, is $16,500. I wonder if he'd accept such a gift, or if his therapist would agree that it's a good idea. He'd still need money for repairs and food, and he has not a dollar. All of the donations to his cause went to restitution, and he owes more. Knight had specifically asked me not to interfere in his life, so I veto buying him the cabin and fly home. I write him a letter. I absolutely cannot stand the thought that you may choose to take a stroll with the Lady of the Woods. I do not tell his caseworker or anyone else in Knight's life about the suicide risk, but every month or so I write again, through spring and summer and into fall. There's no reply. When November arrives, the time of his threat, I can stand it no longer. I book a flight to Maine, and 10 days before I leave, I send him a brief note saying I'm on my way. My wife calls me while I'm changing planes in New York. A postcard has arrived from Knight. Urgently important that you leave me alone, she reads to me over the phone. Show me respect by leaving me alone. Please, if you appear, I will call police. Leave me alone, please. I fly back without seeing him. Winter descends, and I try to keep tabs on Knight. Every North Pond resident I speak with says the past 2 summers without the hermit have been the most carefree in memory. People have been leaving their cabin doors unlocked, like in the old days. It's just done, says Jody Mosher Towell, editor of the twice-yearly bulletin, The North Pond News. It's in the past. Nobody wants to hear about the hermit anymore around here, because it's like, yeah, whatever. Maloney, the DA, emails to tell me that Knight continues to arrive in court promptly every Monday and is doing fantastically well. So at least I know he's alive. At the end of winter, Maloney announces that Knight has completed the co-occurring disorders and veterans court, and on March 23, 2015, he will officially graduate. It's been nearly 2 years since his arrest at Pine Tree. His performance in this court has been flawless.